Today on Pilot's Discretion, our guest is photographer, writer, and pilot David Tulis. He tells us about flying a tri-pacer across the country, how to take great air-to-air photos, and lessons learned from an off-field landing. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion from Sporties. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for show links and complete archives, and send us an email with your comments or guest ideas, podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm excited to have David Tulis on the show. He is a very accomplished photographer, having covered 8 presidents, dozens of Super Bowls, and a whole lot more. But he's also a longtime pilot and aircraft owner. So about 10 years ago, he went to work for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. At AOPA, he has become a true multimedia journalist, writing articles for AOPA Pilot and AOPA Flight Training magazines, creating videos for AOPA's website, and even hosting AOPA's very popular Hangar Talk podcast. Most importantly, at least for me, David is a real aviation enthusiast who loves to talk about airplanes. David, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thank you for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be with you, and congrats on the podcast. You're up to you're in the 70s episodes right now. So how many years have you guys been doing Pilot's Discretion?
We're into year 3, so it's become a thing.
That's outstanding. And you were on one of our first podcasts at Hangar Talk with Ian Twombly, where we went over some gifts that people could buy around the holiday time. So once again, thanks for participating on our end.
Well, that we're going to make the circle complete now. So I wanted to start out by asking you about a great story you did last year. One of my favorite stories of 2023. You described the process of buying and flying home a gorgeous 1953 Piper Tri-Pacer, and you stumbled across this while on assignment in Oregon. So I have lots of questions about the flight and the lessons learned, but start by telling us why you fell in love with the Tri-Pacer.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, John, I was not looking for a Tri-Pacer at all. I was looking for an airplane for my family. I live in Maryland, and my daughter was going to school at the time in Nashville, Tennessee. So I was looking for something like a Bonanza, an older VTOL, something I could afford like $50,000 or less, or an older Mooney, because I had some experience with the retractable Johnson Bar Moonies. And indeed, I was on assignment at Hood River, Oregon, at the WAM Museum. That's the Western Antique Aeroplane and Automobile Museum. I was there with features writer Julie Walker and senior photographer at that time, Chris Rose, who's now my boss. And I was acting as the videographer on that trip. So we're tooling around the WAM Museum, and it's a fascinating place. If your listeners haven't been there, I would highly recommend that they attend. And every September, by the way, there's a pretty neat fly-in. It's a museum where they fly airplanes about every 2 weeks. They kind of rotate through 130-some-odd aircraft. So the airplanes are flying, and there's a rotation, as I mentioned. Anyway, we go into the the rebuild hangar, you know, where it's where they're tweaking stuff and there's wrenching going on. And in the back of this hangar, there's this 1953 Piper Tri-Pacer, cream and red, and it's sharing hangar space with a de Havilland Beaver, a Cessna 206. There was some kind of a biplane in there that I was unfamiliar with, made by Travel Air. And there were a couple of other airplanes that were, you can tell they were in the process of being fixed up and ready to be sold. So I'm like getting video of the museum, and we're talking to Terry Brandt, who's the founder and owner of that museum. And there's an actual garage sale sign on the propeller of this Tri-Pacer in the corner. And it, you know, said how many hours was on it and how much they wanted. And I just like went right past it. And Julie Walker and Chris Rose both said, "Hey, Dave T, that airplane's calling you." And I was like, "No, it's not. You know, I don't know anything about them. I knew that Piper made them, but I really wasn't familiar with, you know, with the marquee." And I was looking for something more, you know, sleek and fast, something like that. But the price was right, I got to tell you. I'm not ashamed to admit it had a price on $40,000. And it was a museum restored Piper Tri-Pacer. Now, John, let me tell you. Jim Jenkins was the restorer, Jim and his son, and they were and still are widely known as these short wing piper experts. The airplane was restored from tip to tail, and it was just gorgeous. I mean, a vintage panel, but with, you know, a couple of had a modern radio and an intercom and a transponder. But other than that, round dial gauges, and you could just tell that a lot of love was put into this airplane. So I looked at it and I was like, nah, I don't think so. That afternoon, we're settled down for some drinks after our assignment, and the subject came up again. And I said, you know, I'm just not looking for something like that. And we were sitting down, and Julie Walker said, David, that airplane needs to be yours. And then Chris Rose leaned over and said, hey, I'm not even a pilot, but if you don't buy it, I will. So that got the wheels turning, and they dropped me off the next morning to take another look at it. I looked at the logbooks, and they looked fine. They had all the logbooks were there. It was a definite restoration that took, you know, years to go through, and almost $100,000.
Wow.
I was told. Yeah. And so I went up to Terry later that day and I said, hey, Terry, do you think you could live with $38,000? And he said, David, I tell you what, I can live with exactly $40,000 like it's on the sale sign, and not a penny less or not a penny more. And so we shook hands on the deal. And I talked to my brother in Atlanta, who's a classic car enthusiast, and he helped back me on the funds, to be quite honest with you. But we got a deposit over there, and before you know it, I was a TriPacer owner. And that was on Halloween of 2022. So just to give you a time frame, John, the weather turned bad at that point, and I really wanted to get the airplane back across the country to Maryland, but it took 6 months before the weather got better.
Well, you allude to it there. Buying the airplane's one thing. Bringing it home, especially from Oregon to Maryland, is a whole nother adventure. And I find those long cross countries in low and slow airplanes so much fun, so rewarding, but it can be quite challenging. It can be stressful. And you recount this great story, you know, flying over the mountains at 12,000 feet, landing in a 30 knot crosswind.
Yeah.
You're inevitably going to find those situations when you cross the country. So how do you build the confidence to make a trip like that? And what's your advice for someone who's considering a voyage like that?
Well, those are two good questions, and many people have asked me that. So first of all, you alluded to the fact that I learned in a 30-knot crosswind. That's true. Yeah, Hood River, Oregon, I'm a former windsurfer. That is where people would go windsurfing. I mean, it's like a wind tunnel. So the wind's blowing like 20 to 30 knots, and once I finally got out there, it was March of 2023. And so I figured out, you know, it's blowing 30. I'm certainly not going to go flying today. So Lars Lundquist, who was the instructor over there at Hood River at, he was saying, no, this is a normal day. So just go ahead and get in there and strap on in and let's go. So that was my first indoctrination to the Wild West, if you would. But I knew I needed a couple hours of flight training with a real instructor, someone who is versed in, you know, ragwing and tube airplanes like the Piper, TriPacer, the Pacer line. Over there at Hood River, they use Cub Crafters Super Cubs a lot to teach people. So it's that Tech Aero was the name of the place that was kind of holding my airplane for me and looking out for it. And so I learned over there, and it was great. It was a high mountain experience at the Hood River area because immediately around it is high terrain. Now, I live on the East Coast, and I have flown over the Appalachians before. I had a little air coupe, and I flew from Atlanta, Georgia to Wisconsin. We'll talk about that maybe later. But there are real mountains on the East Coast, but there are nothing like the mountains that are on the West Coast. So how do you tackle something like that? First thing I did, John, to be honest with you, was set up some good mentors. And I have a really good one at AOPA. My flight instructor of note is Dave Hirschman, editor at large. Folks probably will recognize his name. He and I met back in Atlanta. We worked for the same newspaper for a number of years, and I followed him up to AOPA. So Dave's my flight instructor, and I got him to look at the proposed route that I had. And he said, no, Tulis, that's not how you're going to do it. you're going to go, you know, you're going to basically cross the country here, and you're going to try to cross the mountains over north of Salt Lake City. And he gave me some waypoints and some, a lot of, really a lot of background. And I'd broken it down into 4 days of flying, day one, day two, day three, day four. So I shared that information with one of our West Coast editors, Alicia Heron. She lives in California, and she's a CFI as well. And when she was younger, her family vacationed around the area that I was going to fly through. And some of the, you know, there was a particular pass that I was looking at flying around. And she said, no, David, that's not what you're going to do. You're going to go, you're going to fly north first. You're going to go on the east side of the mountains here. And then you're going to go around the corner of this little mountain range here and come south. And then you're going to fly east. And the reason why Alicia said to do that was because there was more population there. And if there was something that might go wrong, don't forget, this is a 1953 airplane. It actually hadn't flown all that much since it was rebuilt. And so she was coaching me to err on the side of caution. So I did that. And I was listening to Dave, I was listening to Alicia. And I'd first day I wanted to fly about 600 miles, which is about two tanks of gas, basically flying to about 300 miles or so, landing, filling up, and jumping in and doing it again. And she cautioned me not to do that. She said, you're going to be tired. It's your first day. It's a new airplane. You know, consider a shorter, you know, segment. So I'm thinking, yeah, whatever, you know. I'm a pilot. I can handle this. Anyway, I get going at Hood River, and my takeoff was delayed because there was a last minute issue with the nose strut. Didn't quite have enough air in it, nitrogen. So that got fixed. And then the nav light on the right side needed a little bit of cleanup because it was intermittent, and there might have been a possibility of me flying around sunset. So the techs over there said, no, wait, you're not leaving until we're completely satisfied. Everything is good. You got a long flight, 2,300 miles or so. And so I got going later than I would, probably around noon, to be honest with you. And I made it as far as Mountain Home, Idaho. But the first thing I see, I take off out of Hood River, and I call Seattle Center. And I get a little bit of flight following because I figure that's cockpit resource management. Right. I wanted that. And you're not that far from Hood River in that area, the Columbia River Gorge. Then all of a sudden, John, it's mountains and snow and evergreens and no people and more mountains and more snow and higher terrain and no people. And it just scared the, you know what, out of me. Like all of a sudden I was thinking, well, this is for real, you know? And so I'm flying along and navigating and getting to know the airplane a little bit better. As I had about 4 or 5 hours on the ground at Hood River, but I was getting to know the airplane better. It's nuances and the radios were a little challenging. The pilot's window kept popping open. It was 20 degrees on the ground. This is still the winter time. I was at 9,000-10,000 feet. So it was, you know, like zero. And wind coming in. So I was like, with my pinky, I'm holding the window vent closed. It's on a tri-pacer. It's a over center kind of a bracket. And so before you know it, I had on two pairs of gloves, you know, had a hoodie on, and it was just cold, but made it to Mountain Home, Idaho. So I get to Mountain Home, Idaho, and I land there, and it's dusk, you know, and I'd put in a good 3.5 hours of flying and I was done for the day. Alicia was right. She's like, yep, don't bite off more than you can chew. So airport manager there was super nice, told him what I was doing. And he advised me to go the next day. He said, here's what you're going to do, David. You're going to fly at 11,500 feet towards the Medicine Bow Wilderness. And you're going to see a mountain or two, and you're going to pick left, or you're going to pick right. Don't pick the middle, pick left or right. I said, okay, I'll do that. So I sort of, you know, I had his advice. I had Dave Hirschman's advice. And I had planned to land in Casper, Wyoming to begin with, on one of the legs. And I remember Dave Hirschman said, "Dave T, you will not land in Casper, Wyoming. There will be no Casper the Friendly Ghost for you. It's super windy there. Pick Cheyenne instead, Rock Springs, and then Cheyenne." And I said, "Okay, Dave." But first, I had to cross the Rockies, which came right before that. So indeed, I did fly out towards Medicine Bow Wilderness. I was behind a high, you know, so it was blue skies, about a 20 knot northwesterly wind, not quite a tailwind, but it helped a little bit. That's come about 110 miles per hour across the ground, maybe 120. And sure enough, I'm at, before you know it, and I'm taking pictures and video, you know, because I'm a photo geek. And before you know it, I'm getting close to the Medicine Bow Wilderness. And I crossed the jagged peaks of the Rockies. And I was about, at that point, I was about 11,500, almost 12,000 feet. And I'm going along, and the ground is still rising. I mean, like, terrain is rising. And I wanted to be on the east side of the taller mountains in case there were winds that were going to push me down, because I only have 135 horsepower engine. And so I kind of planned that. I kept looking at the winds aloft, and I thought I had a pretty good plan going, and it was working. And I had the confidence, the big C, and of course I had flight following. And then all of a sudden, ATC gets on the horn and they say, "TriPacer 3328 Alpha, you do know the minimum in route altitude in that area is 14,000 feet. What are your intentions?" And although they were, you know, more used to it being an IFR person and I was flying VFR, it completely popped the balloon of confidence that I had because I'm thinking, oh man, you know, they're right. You know, it's pretty high. And the mountains in front of me were at 12.5 about, but I chose a valley just to the left, and it was a beautiful day. And honestly, John, I could see the valley opening up behind it. So I put my camera away, you know, and really concentrated on flying, and made it over the highest part of the terrain there. Shot a little video as I crossed over with the GoPros and entered in this valley towards Rock Springs. And that was kind of like the highest part of the trip, but certainly not the toughest part. But it got me thinking, you know, you really need good mentorship. You really need good planning. You need a plan A and a plan B, maybe a plan C. And I think putting all that together helped me get across the Rockies. I mean, 135 horsepower engine is not much, mm-hmm. you know, and those Pacers and TriPacers come with 150, 160 horsepower engines as well. A little bit later on, they modified them to that or had them that way from the factory. But it served me well. The airplane was running great. I just still couldn't figure out how to work the heat controls. I was like freezing my buns off in the airplane. I had to open up the front cabin heater vent, and I was just still couldn't get warm. I was like sitting on my fingers, you know, and I was holding the window closed. And, you know, finally I put a zip tie around that, which helped it. And then much later on, I wonder if I pull the control for the back seats, what would happen? So like 2 days later, I'd pull the, you know, heater control for the back seats. And it was like, have you ever played pool, play billiards at all?
Yep.
The air came in, bounced off the bottom of the back seat, up to the headliner, over to the windshield, and then back into my face. And all of a sudden I was toasty warm and took all my gloves off and everything. So, but it took 3 days to figure that out. So,
that's how you know you're flying a vintage airplane when the heater is finicky. So
that's
right. I have sympathy for that.
And the POH doesn't have a whole lot about it in there. You know, these are real bare bones, you know, POHs. But that got me across the Rockies, got me to Rock Springs. I celebrated with leftover hamburger I had from the night before. I landed for fuel there. And then got back in the airplane, dodged some snow showers at that point, and went over to Cheyenne, Wyoming for the night. And I would like to find out from you or your listeners if they've been to Cheyenne, Wyoming. John, I know you fly fixed wing, you fly rotorcraft. Have you been to Cheyenne?
I have been to Cheyenne one time on a similar trip out west. So I was headed westbound, and that was my stop.
So I'm in the Tri-Pacer, and it's been windy the whole time. And so the first clue when approaching from the west that it's going to be sporty, no pun intended, sporty landing, is there are windmills at the end of the runway, you know, about a mile, you know, west of the airport. And I was thinking, oh, my God, you know, and it's still blowing like 20 to 30 on the ground the whole trip. But I landed there. The folks at the FBO were super cool. Quick story on that landing. So again, the sun's fixing to set. I've been flying all day, and it was cold, mighty cold and windy. And so the line personnel said, "All right, do you want to put your airplane in the hangar? Or you want to tie it down?" I said, "Well, you know, I think I just tie it down." And one of the personnel out there, her name was Lauren, and my daughter's name was Lauren, so I remember that. And I said, "Well, Lauren, I'll just tie it down." So she goes, "Okay, I'm going to go inside and get the ropes." Because I said, "Well, how much was the hanger?" It's $85. I said, "No, I'll tie it down or roll with the dice." And so she goes inside, gets the ropes, comes back, and it only took about 3 minutes. And I couldn't feel my fingers. I was like standing outside the airplane, couldn't feel them. I said, "Lauren, I hate to do this. Let's push this airplane into a hangar for the night. I'm going for the 85. Let's do it." So one of the lessons learned, you know, when you're flying across the country and it's you're in an unfamiliar airport and it's in the wintertime and you have a vintage airplane, roll it into a hangar that's heated, keep the battery happy, you know, because I didn't want to come out the next morning and have a dead battery or, you know, very, very cold aircraft or, you know, an unhealthy engine, that kind of thing. And so spend the money, you know, and keep things happy. So anyway, that got me over to Cheyenne. And then at that point, folks will tell you when you're going across the country, it's basically downhill from there, from the west to the east. This huge state of Nebraska that you're, you know, crisscrossing, then Missouri, and then, you know, you end up in Ohio, and then it's clear sailing from that.
So many good lessons you learn on a trip like that, usually by being pushed outside your comfort zone, like you mentioned. It makes me think, though, with vintage airplanes in particular, because you mentioned you own an aircoupe beforehand.
I did.
And so for people who are looking for affordable flying, a lot of times we talk about LSAs, experimental home-built has exploded in popularity over the last decade or two. I sometimes wonder if we don't give enough of a look at vintage airplanes. So as a multiple-time owner, what would you say about considering an aircoupe, a Tri-Pacer, or something like that for somebody who's looking to get into aviation at an affordable price point? Is it a good path to consider?
I think it is, John. I think it is. I'm glad you brought it up. Even the least expensive new LSAs are over $100,000, you know, $200,000. It's not unheard of to be $400,000. So yeah, I think something that's in the $20,000 to $40,000 range is a good way to start. The aircoupe I bought, it was kind of a basket case. It was still flying, but it probably shouldn't have been. I bought it for about $13,000. That was in the year 2000, though. But then I put in about $25,000, so almost double what I paid for it, to bring it up to, you know, the year 2000 standards. But it needed a complete engine rebuild. The wings were okay, but it had like really bad avionics, nose fork, things like that. However, if the bones of the aircraft are good, in the aircoupe's case, you want to make sure it doesn't have any corrosion around the rear spar or the wing. And in the Tri-Pacer's case, you want to make sure that the tubes underneath the fabric are good. You also want to make sure the fabric is good. If you've got good bones, so to speak, just like a house, I think it's a good way to go. The aircraft don't have to be the sexiest looking aircraft. They don't have to be the slickest, shiniest, but good basic transportation, I think, gets a lot of pilots across the finish line when you're a student pilot or when you are a new pilot and you want to build some time. In the case of the aircoupe, you know, I had this idea, well, I'll get the aircoupe and I'll use that for training. And well, none of that worked. I mean, I bought the aircoupe and at the same time I was finishing my pilot training, the aircoupe was nearing completion. And then it was a showpiece after that. And I ended up flying it up to AirVenture in 2003, and it won Best Air Coupe.
Wow.
So that was kind of cool. And I had an old-looking panel with modern avionics, and I used flight following all the time. I was living in Atlanta. You know, negotiating the Class B airspace was a key thing. So I had a good transponder, good radio, you know, good basic six-pack of avionics. And then the flight controllers would always ask me to repeat what type of aircraft I was, because they just don't hear an air coupe pilot asking for, you know, flight service, you know, ATC services. But I pretended as if I was an instrument pilot, because I was trying to, you know, study my instruments and head for that rating. I've been doing that for 20 years, so to speak. So, and in the tri-pacer, the same thing. It's like, you know, ATC doesn't often anticipate you telling them that you're in that kind of a vintage airplane and you're playing with the big boys. But a tri-pacer, you asked about for value added airplane. I think that is a good one, John. The Pacer line is good. That whole line is short wing Pipers, which includes the Colt, the Vagabond, and others are really, really good because it's affordable aviation transportation. I'm looking at about 7.2 gallons an hour of fuel burn in the Tri-Pacer. Insurance is less in the Tri-Pacer than it is on my 2009 Honda CR-V SUV. And in the Air Coupe, the insurance was about the same 20 years ago as the Tri-Pacer's insurance is now. So that really hadn't gone up. But they're not tailwheel airplanes, and they're not retractable. But I do think that's good. I think that that listeners should do some homework, get a good pre-buy, as we always stress, and then join the type clubs for the gotchas. You know, there are a couple of gotchas in the short wing Piper crowd. You know, that they'll tell you about, and there is same for an air coupe. Yeah, you can probably lump the 150, 152 Cessnas in that as well as Champs and other aircraft of similar vintage.
All right, David, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about photography a little bit.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses, so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at Sporties.com and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at Sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with David Tulis, who has spent nearly his whole life as a photographer, and not just aviation. So, David, tell me why you think photos remain important, even in a world of YouTube videos and TikToks and everything. Why is a still photo still worth doing?
Well, a still photo captures the moment, John. We all like to do some videos, and we have more access to cameras now than we ever did because they're on our phones. They're everywhere. But that still photo moment, it just captures the essence of the height of expression, or the loneliness of defeat. You know, we just can relate to it. It freezes a moment in time. And I think it relates to people. And golly, like even when you get married, there's a special moment, you know, that you want the photographer to capture. Or when you are graduating from high school or from college, there's that moment of joy. You know, it's like, yeah, I did it. And so a still photo captures that really, really dramatically. And listen, don't forget, the internet is a very visually driven medium right now. And so there's a resurgence of photography. In fact, there's a resurgence for black and white film photography, which might surprise some people. So, yeah, if you have a camera, dust it off, get it going. They still make film. I used to develop that in my mom's attic. And then at UPI, I developed color film and the the back of stadiums or in bathrooms, or that we'd plastic over the windows to get them dark and cover the president and things like that. So yeah, get your hands wet in some photography and, old school photography. It's never too late.
Do you have one good tip for taking better aviation photos? I'm going up and I want to get a good picture and I'm not a pro. What should I do or not do?
Well, do you want to get the picture, John, from the air to the ground or from one airplane to another aircraft?
Well, let's give me one of both. I'm greedy.
Okay. All right. So air to ground, I think the first thing is that, first of all, if you're a pilot, fly the airplane. Don't do your photography unless someone else is with you that's qualified to fly the aircraft. But air to ground, you need a faster shutter speed. You need about 1/1000th of a second or faster because the airplane's going to move anywhere from, 80 miles an hour to 200 miles an hour. The faster the shutter speed, the better it is, but make sure you're not photographing another moving aircraft if it has a propeller at that fast of a shutter speed. If you're using an iPhone, get close to the plexiglass or you're going to get reflections. To that extent, it's better to wear darker colors, gray or black, so you don't have so many reflections. And you can actually put the lens of the camera right on the plastic or right next to it and kind of cup your hand over it and block out some of the reflections that are pretty much all over a cockpit of an airplane. So that's our air-to-ground tip. Fast shutter speed. Look out for reflections that are unwanted. And always look at your background first. That's what they taught me at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Look at the background first and then look at what you're photographing. So now if we're photographing an air-to-air mission, and it's another aircraft, the converse is true on the shutter speed. You want a very slow shutter speed to capture the dynamic prop blur of a propeller-driven airplane. Now, as far as it goes for a jet, it doesn't matter. But about a 1/100th of a second or less, and often a 1/60th of a second is better. Now you've introduced airplane shake, camera shake, and subject airplane shake into the same component there. So you've got to really have some internal stabilization with your lenses. A lot of modern camera lenses have that, and cameras have that as well in their bodies. So keep that in mind. But go for 125th of a second or 100th of a second or less, not more, but less, as in longer exposures. And try not to brace yourself on the aircraft frame. Maybe use your body, like tuck your elbows into your rib cage, that kind of thing, because it gives you a little bit of cushion. It's like a shock absorber. One thing that we do like to use if we can is a little filter device called a circular polarizing filter. And that it's a filter that goes over your lens. And if you dial it in correctly, John, dial it in to the point where it kind of sees through glare of your subject airplane so you can see the people inside flying. The next thing I would say, and this is probably the most important thing for air-to-airs, is you really need to know who you are flying with, and you need to have a pre-flight briefing in detail of what the mission is, including emergencies, emergency frequencies, emergency landing sites, talk about the speeds that you're going to fly. I mean, if it's a bona fide air-to-air mission and it's, semi or pro professional, if you're going out flying with your friends, just make sure that everyone is doing a left turn, if we're all doing left turns, or everyone's doing a right turn, because you don't want to mix it up in the air. So slow shutter speeds, really good briefing. And be serious about it. Put your phones away and talk about this with as much concentration as you can have. Helicopters, because you're a helicopter guy, right?
That's right.
So if you're photographing helicopters, 1/60th of a second is almost too fast of a shutter speed for a helicopter. So you've got to really slow that shutter speed down. It's a very challenging thing to do. Oftentimes, the angle from up above looking down on a helicopter is kind of a sexier angle. It's a better angle. Helicopters usually, you know, brightly painted. The blades have some bright spots on them. And so that might be a really cool look to think about instead of from the ground up. So a couple of quick tips. The other thing, fill the frame. Fill the frame with your subject. Get in close when you can, or use a zoom if you can't get in close. But don't forget the big picture. Like a photojournalist would approach any assignment, get the big picture first. Establish the shot. Establish what's going on. Then get your medium lens type photo, which would mean either getting closer to the other airplane physically or flying further away for the bigger picture. And then go for the detail shots. You know, maybe the sun glistening off of a reflective wing surface or something like that. And we only have about half the airplane in your frame. You know, you're cutting the wings off it, which is okay if you're looking for a particular moment or scene or look. But clouds can make good pictures too. So don't forget that. And don't forget ground features underneath the aircraft. So keep the whole scene in mind, whether you're doing photojournalism or aviation photography.
Excellent tips. That is great stuff. Well beyond just the typical, make sure it's in focus. So
do that.
Thanks,
too.
David. We always end this show with a lightning round we call Ready to Copy. I like to ask some questions on a wide variety of topics, and you fire back with your quick answer. I've got tons of these, so we'll see how many we get through. Are you ready to copy?
Yeah, I'm ready to copy, John. First thing I'm going to say, Coke, not Pepsi.
Well, you already answered that question.
From Atlanta. I mean, what can I say?
I got another question on that, so you're not off the hook yet. What is your favorite aviation story you've ever participated in?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Well, you know, flying across the country in the Tri-Pacer was a key moment, that's one never to be duplicated. But I had a great time flying recently with Dave Hirschman across the Inner Passage of Alaska. We were in a Cessna Caravan, and it was stellar scenery. That's something that I would say is one of my favorites. And there was another story, John, that actually has peripherally to do with aviation, but it was just something that warmed my heart so much. It was a group of aviators that had pitched in to give some veterans, folks who had gone to fight for our country and were younger. They were younger veterans. Some had PTSD, and some were struggling a little bit in life, but an aviator chipped in enough money for them to raft down the Green River in Colorado and Utah. And so I spent 3 days rafting down the Green River, and I'm still friendly with that group of folks. And to me, it's about the aviation community. So that's another standout for me. I'm sure there are many, many more. You know, all the folks I've met through the years, they've all helped me out as subjects. You know, if I'm writing a story, doing photography, but Green River was a key moment, flying across the country, another, and Alaska was yet a third.
How about a photo? I'm going to make you pick one photo. Is there one from your entire career that stands out that you just can't forget?
Well, yeah, actually, that's an easy one. I was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 1988, so I'm kind of old. Yeah, folks who don't see me. I've got, you know, gray hair and all, but I've been in the business for a while. But yeah, in 1988, there was a fire in Atlanta. It was a high-rise fire. And unfortunately, the fire trucks didn't have ladders long enough to reach the top floors of this building. And so I got a photo of a worker. He had smashed through the glass and was holding his coworker out the window for clean air when smoke was billowing all around. And unfortunately, the coworker didn't make it. He died of smoke inhalation. But as a journalist, it was a key moment because the city of Atlanta then took a look at all of the fire codes that they had in high-rise buildings and fire trucks and ladders and things like that. And they changed the fire code to have sprinklers mandatory in buildings over a certain height. And up to that point, it was sort of haphazard. So it was a sad story, but yet a journalistic highlight. And I was a finalist for that in the Pulitzer Prizes of that year. Unfortunately, the Berlin Wall came tumbling down that year, so I lost out to a bigger cause, but that's okay.
Wow, great story. Do you like shooting airplanes or people more?
People.
You gave us some great photo tips. How about podcasting? Do you have one mistake never to make if you're on a podcast? And I'm taking notes here.
Yeah. Early on when Ian Twombly and I were doing our podcast, I mean, even still, folks listening today, they could probably hear me breathing, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, we didn't have these spit guards and things like that. So they could really hear me, you know, breathing like that. So podcasting, sit up. I'm trying to sit up straight right now and enunciate. And I get excited, but not too excited. So, you know, when you get excited, you cut off the ends of your words, the ends of your sentences. You relate okay to your listeners, you know, they say, oh yeah, this person's into it. But on the flip side, you still need to complete that thought, complete that sentence and be professional. So I'd say be professional, maybe take some voice coach lessons. Clearly you can see I failed when I took my voice coaching lessons, but no, take some voice coaching lessons. I think that's a key thing for any podcaster for sure.
The podcast I want to hear is the Dave and Dave Show. Dave Hirschman, David Tulis, traveling the country by airplane, finding the greatest $100 hamburgers. One, a Southern gentleman. One, the gnarly flight instructor. I would sign up for that and fund that. So
he's gnarly. He's a tough flight instructor. Oh, my God.
So let me know when the Dave and Dave Show happens.
Well, he and I get along like oil and water, but I tell you, we love each other at the end of the day, and he's a great mentor. And Dave Hirschman is my flight instructor of note. I mean, I do my 2-year reviews with him. I got my tailwheel sign off with Dave. I thought he was gonna clock me and knock me out from the back seat of a Piper Super Cub, but I finally got it together. Dave and Dave would be good. You know, he doesn't eat very much on a trip, so he might just have an apple or a granola bar. So, which you probably do know from flying with him, but. Yeah, Dave and Dave would be great. And maybe it could be Dave, and John to come along.
Oh, be scary. What's an important job AOPA does that most members don't know about? Something goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, great question. I think the number one job that people don't realize that AOPA does is we have a huge advocacy in Washington, D.C. that is very, very important. We want to keep airspace open. We don't want laws and taxes to be too onerous for aircraft owners. And that goes on behind the scenes, but it's super important. Let me give you one quick example. Right now in Maryland, there's an effort to get sales taxes eliminated from some aircraft parts. You would think that's like, okay, that's boring. Who cares? Well, the thing is, aircraft owners in this state would just cross the line and go to Virginia if Virginia had no sales tax and you're buying a new Garmin radio for $12,000, you know, and 6% of that is significant money. So that's one thing AOPA does. In the Piper Cub, Tri-Pacer, Pacer world, which there are 31,000 tube and fabric Pipers out there, there's a NOSA proposed rulemaking on the rudder post right now that would affect 31,000 aircraft. And that's about 15% of the entire GA fleet, which is 210,000 aircraft. So our advocacy folks have worked with the type clubs to try to get the FAA to really think twice about that. And there's really no reason for such a huge sweeping proposed AD when there really hasn't been enough research done. So the advocacy folks, that's what goes on behind the scenes. That's what your membership dollars go for. The magazine and everything else is just Lanny app. You know, it's cool stuff to look at. But the main thing is making sure we have the freedom to fly always.
You had a very interesting video a while back about an experience you had in the Mooney making an off-airport landing. And we'll link to that. Folks can go see that. But
sure.
What's the takeaway there for getting passengers back in an airplane? We can talk about lessons learned as a pilot, but how do you handle the non-pilot part of it, the more emotional relationship part?
Well, that is interesting, John, because what happened to me is back in the day, I had a F model Mooney and I did have an off airport landing in Mississippi, in Flowood, Mississippi. If I was by myself, I probably would have landed on, you know, in trees or something, or, you know, I was in an area that was wooded and there wasn't much. There were really no private airfields around. There were no paved airstrips around. I ended up landing on a divided highway and came swooping in under one set of traffic lights and put the landing gear down and landed before the next set of traffic lights. And it would have been just fine, except for I tell people I contacted a pickup truck upon rollout. And so it spun the airplane around. Nobody got hurt or anything like that. My wife and daughter were with me. My wife, Lisa, was a reluctant pilot to begin with. She's only flown with me one other time since then. And my daughter, Lauren, was 19 months old. She's flown with me many, many times. She doesn't remember that at all. And there was nothing I could do to make that airplane not have a catastrophic engine failure. It was one of the freak accidents that we read about where a through bolt had cracked inside the engine casings. And when that cracked, the folks on the ground, including an FAA investigator, came up to me and he said, "Son, it's just like a zipper. When one of those big through bolts pops, it's like pop, 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 pop." And one of the cylinders separated like 6 inches from the engine. And oil, of course, poured down on the exhaust pipe, and there's smoke in the cockpit and everything. But key takeaway, I did get my wife, Lisa, to fly with me again. We flew down to Nashville, Tennessee, in Belmont University, where my daughter was going to college. And what made the difference then was we took a AOPA maintained aircraft that looked brand new, exterior and interior and radios, everything worked on the aircraft. It was not like getting in an airplane where there were ripped seats, scratches on the panel, anything like that. So I think getting the passengers comfortable with the aircraft and the maintenance of it is the key. Having said that, I've even looked into right now on the TriPacer seeing if I could put AmSafe airbag seatbelts in it, you know. But I would say if your passengers are still reluctant, you just have to leave them behind. Sure. Don't force them into flying with you. One cool story about that, I know we're on lightning round, but on the M20F model Mooney, I was going out with my daughter and my wife, and we were going to visit my wife's very ill father in Louisiana. And I strapped my daughter, Lauren, into a child seat and into the seat behind me. And I had already cranked up the airplane and was turning the radios on. And I looked over to Lisa, my wife, and said, "Lisa, I am not happy about how I strapped Lauren into that child seat. I'm going to turn everything off and start over." And I did. I turned everything off and went back and relashed the seat belt through her child safety seat and everything, made sure she was super secure. And then what do you know? You know, like 2.5 hours later, we're landing on a highway and
wow,
and contacting a pickup truck. So it was that sixth sense. But don't be too fast when you're doing your pre-flights. You know, if something doesn't feel right, just like in photography, if something feels icky, stop and ask someone, ask an editor, "Hey, you know," and in that case, something fell off. And so I stopped and reassessed.
All right. You used to live in Atlanta, as you mentioned. I lived in Atlanta for about 10 years as a kid. So I've got a couple of quick Atlanta questions. You already answered the Coke or Pepsi with Coke. That was obvious.
And same, I'm going to think the same for you, but I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
You're correct. But let's say I'm having fried chicken at Mary Mac's Tea Room, right?
Okay.
Am I drinking Coke or sweet tea?
Oh, sweet tea.
Okay. Correct answer. Another Atlanta question. Should Dale Murphy be in the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Absolutely. I've met Dale Murphy. I photographed him when I was at UPI back in the day. And not only is he a super nice guy, but he was like the best player on that team in the 80s when they were terrible. Bob Horner was pretty good too.
I grew up watching those teams and they were awful. And Dale Murphy's the only thing that kept me going.
He's a great guy too.
All right. Bass guitar. You play it.
I do.
The most overlooked instrument, I think, in my opinion. So Jaco Pastorius or Victor Wooten, who's your guy?
You know what? I think I'm going to go with Victor. I tell you why. I like Jaco and I like Weather Report and I like all that, but Jaco, as good as he was, I just, you know, that kind of jazzy feeling is just not my cup of tea. So I'll go with Victor Wooten on that one.
All right. Our last question, always the same in this podcast. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Ooh, baby. One final flight. where am I going? I guess I'm going to, you know, feel real comfortable in a Cessna 182. I've flown that a lot. It's a great family airplane. I'm taking that 182 out to the Grand Canyon. That's my final flight. We're flying around the canyon where it's safe and, you know, where we're not busting any rules or regs. And we're going to take a nice visual look at that canyon in perfect late afternoon sunlight. And then we're going to land on that, I guess, the south rim or the west rim over there at the airport.
David, thanks for being on the podcast.
Glad to be with you, John. It's good to be with you on the podcast, and also great to see you at a lot of these shows. And I just want to thank you and Sporties for everything you guys do for aviation and for aviation training. It is stellar. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. It's a great partnership.
You got it.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.